there. Good morning and welcome to Life Matters, coming to you across the nation on ABC RN. Natasha Mitchell with you. Imagine, though, if I joined you this morning and I was speaking in a thick French accent instead. I'm not even going to try, but yesterday it was my all-too Anglo-Australian voice. Today, French, and it's come from nowhere, and I will never sound like myself again. We're looking at foreign accent syndrome with a world leader on it later. It sounds like a novelty. It's certainly a rare condition, but for the people it happens to, life is never the same. And how other people respond to accents is powerful too. So the power of the voice coming up, plus the power of love found in music. Sarasate's Navara for two violins. We are going to meet the incredible virtuoso couple, Gil Shaham and Adele Anthony. They're in Australia from New York. Can't wait to meet them. We'd love to hear from you throughout the show. Tweet us at RN Life Matters or our listener feedback line for your calls at any time of the day, 02-833-1430. Or you might like to SMS us on this discussion that we're about to have, 0418 226 576, because we are talking schools funding. And who should fund schools? The states? The federal government? Parents? After 4 years of wide consultation for the Gonski Review, you might think we'd reached some consensus around schools funding, but a leaked discussion paper from the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet suggests it could all change again. Yesterday, the media picked up on a small but perhaps the most controversial proposal canvassed in the discussion paper on reforms to the Federation, and that was that wealthy parents should pay fees to send their children to public schools. The federal government was quick to rule that out and has now made the full paper public. It's linked to on our website, so go and check it out. I'll pop it on our Facebook page as well. But Christopher Pine tweeted, "The Australian government does not and will not support a means test for public education. Full stop. End of story." And in another tweet, he said, "If the states and territories want to charge wealthy parents fees for public schools, that's a matter for them." And that is what makes this paper and the reforms that it's proposing, options at least, very interesting indeed. Do these options signal a fundamental shift in the way schools will be funded, with the federal government stepping back and expecting the states to fill the void? Do the states have the capacity to maintain funding for schools at current levels? I'm joined this morning by John Roscombe. He's Executive Director of the Institute of Public Affairs, a free market think tank, and Bronwyn Hinds. She's Policy Fellow at the Mitchell Institute for Health and Education Policy. They're an independent think tank established by Victoria University. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hello.
Bronwyn, I'll start with you. How do you read what's emerged from this discussion paper, which is a draft green paper on reform of the Federation? Does it send a strong signal that the federal government is seeking perhaps to step back in some way from funding schools in the way it does now?
Yes, I do think that. They put forward four different proposals, and three of those involve the government stepping back to a small or extreme degree. I think this could be quite welcome, but it really depends on how it's done. If the Commonwealth were to step back from providing funding for schools from its own budget, it would have to make sure that the states had that money in their own budgets to fill the gap. It can't just walk away, because schools are the most important investment we could really make as a nation, and we'd need to ensure that any decrease in Commonwealth funding was accompanied by a commensurate increase in funding that the states had to fill that gap.
What are the four potential reform proposals for consideration in this paper? And we need to be clear, this is a draft green paper, which now they've released for public viewing.
Absolutely. So they put forward four proposals. These proposals came from discussions that they had with the public, with stakeholders, and with the states, who we must remember actually are the ones responsible for, you know, running school systems. They're the ones with the experience and expertise in this field. Option one, And these options, it was explicitly mentioned, are in no particular order of preference. Mm. Option one, states completely take over schooling. So this would reflect the Constitution, it would provide some clarity, it could enhance accountability, and make it easier for states and school systems to strategically plan and target their money, because they know where it's going to end up. And this is an idea that, in fact, the Gonski panellist Ken Boston thought had great merit. Now,
So no federal involvement?
No federal involvement.
Okay, so that's option one. Let's just list the options if we can.
Sure, of course. Option two is states are responsible for public schools and the federal government responsible for private schools. Now, Pine likes the idea of a direct relationship, but there are some problems that come with this. The states are still responsible for a lot of the regulation that exists, and it could exacerbate inequalities and create the incentive to, you know, cost shift, because if they try to encourage kids to attend the other sector, that means the other government has to pick up, you know, the cost. Option three was reducing federal government involvement in schools, but without significant structural change. And this is what I think is most likely. And this was actually closest to the Gonski Review's recommendations, that the federal government stops trying to steer the ship and stops trying to dictate all the nitty-gritty details of schooling and let the states really get on with running it. But the Commonwealth to provide support and to facilitate some of the bigger changes that all the governments collectively agreed to.
Okay, and option four?
Is where the federal government, Commonwealth government, funds everything to do with schooling, but that the states continue to actually run and implement schools. Now, the federal government, this is where the very controversial proposal about means testing came in. The federal government said that the money they provide for public schools could be based on the estimated capacity of parents in those schools to pay fees. So applying their SES model of funding non-government schools to government schools as well. Now, this has already been ruled out by the federal minister and PM. And I actually think this is the least likely of all. The Commonwealth government does not want to pick up the tab for extra spending in any area.
Although
unlikely.
Although Jane Caro wonders whether the leak of this paper is about softening up the Australian public for a fairly radical change.
It could be, but I can't see the federal government wanting to take on funding for all schools at all. But we do need to have these discussions, because one thing that has come out in the discussions is the statement that public schooling is still free and universal. But when you ask any parent with a child in a public school, or even look at my school websites, you can see that parents with children at public schools are already paying a vast amount in parent fees, and these need intense scrutiny because they're not actually operating as they should, and we need to get back to making schooling more universal and more equitable.
Okay, John Roscombe at the Institute of Public Affairs. So this discussion paper is about shifting the balance between the states and the federal government in the funding and running of schools. Do you think that is a good exercise to undertake?
Yes, it is. It's a discussion we need to have, and I'd share many of Bronwyn's views. The other thing to remember in the context of this discussion paper is it identifies that over the last 10 years, spending on schools has gone up about 50% in real terms, and as yet there's no noticeable improvement in outcomes. The other thing that the discussion paper identifies is that there is mixed accountability. Responsibilities are fudged between the federal and state government, and this is what the federalism paper attempts to unravel. From my perspective, the idea of parents being charged to attend government schools or public schools is definitely something we need to talk about.
Definitely something we need
absolutely
to talk about.
For two key philosophical reasons, I'd argue. One is, why should poorer people pay for Jamie Packer's sons or daughters to go to government schools for free?
Do you reckon Jamie Packer's children are going to government schools at all?
They probably don't, but they could. So I think we have to have that discussion about equity. The other argument, and this is again a philosophical point, is if you go to a school run by a government, you get it free at the point of delivery. If you go to a school run by the non-government sector, You don't. And for me, the question is the provision of education to the highest possible level and best quality, not whether the school is run by a government or by a non-government sector. But it certainly does challenge the prevailing wisdom of government schools and non-government schools in Australia. What's in the discussion paper isn't in fact new. People like I have been talking about this for 10 or 15 years. I think Bronwyn is absolutely correct. This won't be happening any time soon, but it's a really important discussion about how do we improve the quality of our schools, because as the evidence demonstrates, by and large over the last decade, student results haven't improved.
Just picking up on your support for this idea that if parents can afford it, they should consider paying fees for public schools, that fundamentally compromises the principle, philosophical if you like, of universally accessible taxpayer-funded public education in Australia?
No, I'm not sure it does. Access is still available, but the question is, how do you pay for it? At the moment, the idea that government school education is free is a misnomer. Of course, it's paid for by taxpayers through their taxes. So,
and also additional top-up fees that are charged by schools. And when you look at the way in which fees have been added as a burden to parents in public schools, it's incredible increase over the last decade.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. But
in the last 4 years alone, parent fees in public schools has increased by nearly 30%.
And
at the same time that government funding was increasing. Now, when you ask principals why is this the case, why are parents being asked to pay more and more, including for not only the extracurricular things, but in sometimes the instruction, which is actually meant to be free, they say inadequate funding. Now, some people ask, why could this be the case when government funding has increased 50%, you know, in the last decade or so?
Well, why is it the case?
Because funding's not going to where the need is greatest. So, and this is even after the Gonski review. It found that we need to better target our funding, and they come up with a base plus top-ups model, but only a tiny proportion of the new funding actually went to these disadvantaged top-ups. It was spread across all schools, which meant that there was less than to, you know, buffer those schools that really needed that extra support.
Well, where is the Gonski model in all this? John Roscombe, the Gonski proposed a needs-based funding system, so a base funding per student topped up with additional funding for high-need students in high-need schools, perhaps. Have we lost Gonski?
You know, I think we've lost. Oh,
it's going to drop off. The funding is going to drop off for Gonski after 2017, according to the federal government. So where is it? Where is it in even this leaked paper?
I think we've lost half of Gonski. The idea of Gonski to target resources to students in need, in the greatest need, I think is still maintained. The federal government maintains it, the opposition maintains it, and that certainly flows through this discussion paper. What is missing, and I don't think will ever be recovered, is the idea from the Gonski panel that education funding must further be substantially increased. Now, that would be ideal if we had the resources, but the political problem from the Gonski recommendations is that the previous government promised the money, the states committed to spend the money they received, but the money simply wasn't there. So I don't think we've ever lost needs-based funding, and I think that's absolutely central. And the idea that poorer parents are being charged heavier levies, I think, is really dangerous. And if we have a discussion about parents who can afford to pay paying and those who can't afford to pay not paying, then I think we're going to get onto a better path of reform.
Joining me this morning is John Roscombe. He's Executive Director of the Institute of Public Affairs. Bronwyn Hinds is with us. She's a Policy Fellow for the Mitchell Institute for Health and Education. And we've been reading the paper that was leaked. It's a paper reviewing the Federation, and one chapter in it is focusing on education and how education is funded and managed in Australia, the split between the states and the Federation. Four key reform proposals are listed in it for consideration. So, Bronwyn, what's your response to John's take on this idea, and it's only a small idea in this paper, that parents should pay fees if they can afford it for public education?
I think that has the potential to significantly exacerbate the existing inequalities that we have in our schooling system. I think we should try to return to the principle and ideal of universal public education or universally provided education, because it is something that collectively benefits the entire nation. It's something that we should take on as a responsibility and as an institution in which we can have some pride. I'm still very surprised that it's people are talking about parents with greater means providing greater funding for public school education, because this is already
happening.
But some
people think that makes perfect sense, that if people have got the money to pay, should they not invest in their local public school?
Well, they're welcome to, but what I want to say is that this is already happening and it's already creating problems, and the way it's happening isn't actually being properly scrutinised and regulated. The Victorian Auditor General's Office actually did a study on this the beginning of the year. You can read it on their website, VAGO, I think, .vic.gov.au. And it's of the several hundred schools it surveyed, every single one was charging parent fees, and not one single school was actually complying with the Victorian Government's own policy on parent payments. It found that some schools were charging well over $1,000, sometimes much, much more. Other schools charging far less and weren't even able to really collect more than a few dollars, just because their their school and community didn't have a few dollars to put into the school's money tin. So we see exacerbation of existing inequalities rather than trying to improve opportunities. We're actually exacerbating inequalities.
John Roskam, state governments are clearly worried about their capacity to fund schools. So even if the current system stays in place, the level of funding promised by the Gonski model runs out at the end of 2017. And that could point to a very big drop-off after that. So in this paper, you know, you can imagine states are quite worried about some of these proposals, the federal government backing away.
Oh, I absolutely can understand that, but we have to remember that even with the Gonski funding into future years not being delivered, education funding will still increase in absolute terms. The challenge that state governments have had is that they have promised to their stakeholders, to parents and to teachers, very substantial further increases, which I don't think will be coming through. And the broader question that, of course, Bronwyn has raised, and she's right, is how do we redress the inequalities in the government system and public school system that exist now in the well-off suburbs of Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, the capital cities? Government schools are substantially better funded than government schools in poorer districts. And that mainly relates to the cohort of teachers and the salary breakdown of teachers, whereby better experienced teachers wish to teach in easier schools. And I think all state governments, Labor and Liberal, have been trying to redress that. But the best way to address it is, of course, with extra funding. And you're right.
That disparity is really a tragedy of the commons, I think.
I'm not sure it is. It's a tragedy. I would argue it's a tragedy of market failure, whereby a student with special needs, perhaps newly arrived in this country with terrible family circumstances, needs to get substantially more funding than a child from an advantaged background. So to put some numbers on it, if we assume that average government funding to an average student in a government school is $15,000 to $20,000, we might be looking at a student in really disadvantaged, difficult circumstances getting $30,000 to $35,000. Now, no state government has been able to do that. We do that for students with disabilities, but not as yet with students who don't have disabilities. And you are right, it's a disparity we must address, but for me it's a disparity of funding. It's not so much a tragedy of the commons.
Well, Bronwyn Hines, how do we address that disparity? Do these reform options at all respond to that?
I think they do, but it really depends on how they are pursued. So option one, where the states completely take over funding, that could really improve things. The states could entirely, plan for all schools, government and non-government, and really make sure schools get the funding that reflect their need relative to other schools, without another government putting money in the pots and not knowing exactly how those decisions are arrived at or when, and so forth. But this must be accompanied with the commensurate funding increase. You can't just take out $15 billion of funding from the schooling system and expect schools to chug along as if nothing has happened.
Although, as John's pointed out, more money is not equating to improved schools performance in Australia right now. We are falling backwards on every international measure.
Absolutely. And that's because funding has not been going where it's at. You could spend $15 billion on gold blackboards. That's not going to do anything for improved educational outcomes. Likewise, you could spend it entirely on facilities, but we know it's not facilities that make the biggest difference.
It's teachers.
Student learning. It's teachers, it's school
it's
leadership.
It's parents.
It's involving the whole community. It's schools working together. And in fact, we've recently put out a report on the shared work of learning, how you can lift outcomes through greater collaboration. But we need to support these initiatives and learn from these initiatives. And money can help with this. Money alone is not enough. Of course it's not enough. It's how you spend it and what you learn from it and how you share these results.
And we need to value the many hardworking teachers that we have. I'm attracted to the Finnish model where teachers have high status and high pay. Hey, John Roscombe and Bronwyn Hinds, thank you so much for making the time to discuss this paper. And as I mentioned, we'll pop it on the Life Matters website too. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Roscombe, he's Executive Director of the Institute of Public Affairs. Bronwyn Hinds, Policy Fellow at the Mitchell Institute for Health and Education. And please get in touch. Tweet us at RN Life Matters. Our listener feedback line, if you want to let it rip right now, you can ring and leave a message, 0283 1430, 0283 1430. We'll try and get some of those to air tomorrow, or you can get on our website and post a comment with this story, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters, or you can email us too. Look, so many ways to get in touch, or let it go off on the Facebook page. Always love reading your comments there. Natasha Mitchell with you for Life Matters this morning. And imagine if you woke up and you were speaking in a foreign accent that wasn't your own, that you'd never spoken in before, and you could never go back to your original accent. The extraordinary experience of foreign accent syndrome coming up.
On the Health Report podcast, surgeon, writer and health reformer Atul Gawande.
What's your understanding of where you are with your health? What are your fears and worries for the future? What are you willing to sacrifice or not willing to sacrifice? 70% of us will die with someone else having to make decisions for us. And the worst thing we can do to them is not let them know what our priorities are.
And if you want to hear Atul Gawande in conversation with me, Norman Swan, download a Health Report podcast from RN's website.
I prefer nighttime because it's very peaceful. Not many people about.
Would it surprise you if I said that the voice you just heard belongs not to a French woman, but to a Tasmanian woman, born and bred, who's never been to France? The voice belongs to Leanne Rowe. The French accent is not put on. She has a very rare condition called foreign accent syndrome. And so imagine waking up one day and finding that the voice coming from your mouth sounds completely different to the one that you had yesterday. So different that people think you come from another country. We rarely consider how much an accent and the sound of our voice shapes our sense of self. But for those who experience foreign accent syndrome, the loss of their natural accent has a profound impact on their identity. Nick Miller from the University of Newcastle in the UK is a leading researcher into foreign accent syndrome. He's co-written a new book on the whole experience called Foreign Accent Syndromes, The Stories People Have to Tell. He's a professor of motor speech disorders, and he joins me very late in his evening from his home in the UK. Welcome, Nick.
Yeah, nice to be with you there.
Thank you very much for this really intriguing book. And the cases are rare and they are intriguing. And I'm wondering what connected you so closely with this condition and these people's experiences originally.
Well, I'm interested in general in what happens to people's speech after they've had a stroke or after they've had a head injury, when they've had some kind of neurological damage to the brain. And I was interested in the way that might alter your speech and what people can do to help people recover. But then I started coming across in clinic precisely some of the cases you mentioned there, that some people who, well, they don't sound as if they got a speech disorder after their stroke, but they sound as if they're foreign, if they're a French speaker or a Russian speaker, a Chinese speaker or whatever, and yet they're not from China or France or Russia. So that kind of whetted my interest about, well, why should this be so? And that started, I guess, a train of research into looking at what the causes of this are.
Yes, what the mechanisms are. And it occurs in a wide range of countries, this not just English-speaking countries. The accent switch can work in all sorts of directions.
That's right. The reports of people after a stroke in Spain or in Argentina, in Korea or whatever, it's not just an English-speaking nation's phenomenon at all.
Before we come to potential causes, and stroke is clearly a common trigger, but there are other triggers as well, let's just illustrate with an example. And there are really powerful testimonies. You know, often this experience is almost treated as a little bit of a joke in the wider community, in the media. And what I read in those testimonies is actually profound tragedies and a real loss of a sense of self with the loss of their original accent. Tell us about one of the early recorded cases of this syndrome in Norway in 1941, a young woman called Astrid.
That's right. Astrid was a young woman who at the kind of early years of the Second World War was unfortunate enough to be outside during an air raid and ended up with some shrapnel in the left side of her brain, which caused her to be unconscious for several days and lots of operations to save her life. Fortunately, she did recover, but two or three years later, when she was apparently fully recovered, the one thing that hadn't altered hadn't got better was her speech. And so she still had speech which was different to how she'd spoken before the head injury. And the remarkable thing was that her speech to local people sounds as if it was German.
Not Norwegian.
Not Norwegian,
and this was wartime, so the consequences
horrific. The poignant thing about that was, yes, it was during the wartime when Norway was occupied by the Nazis, and so other people who didn't realise she'd been through this head injury and had difficulty walking and talking and whatever, just thought she'd been fraternising with the occupying forces and so started to ostracise her. She wouldn't be served in shops. She was spat at. She was called names and so on and totally isolated. And while that's a really poignant example, I think any person who's suffered from foreign accent syndrome can tell you similar kind of stories, the way that the community in which they've grown up, of which they feel part, of which they identify with, suddenly the people in that community don't identify them as somebody who belongs in that community, as somebody who is one of them. And this alienation, this discrimination almost sometimes is something then that really gets to the heart of people. So,
yes.
All right, they've survived the stroke, they've survived the head injury, but why are you treating me like this?
And then they cop racism. That's right. And some of the stories in the book, contemporary stories, talk about experiencing racism. There's also an Australian story amongst the many that you've collected, and her
That's
experience
right.
really gets to the heart of the sense that people have. They don't just lose their accent, they don't just potentially lose their community, as was Astrid's experience, but they lose a sense of their self as well.
That's right. Well, if you think about your own voice, your own speech, it's very much part of your identity, your own identity, who you feel you are, the picture you portray to other people, or how people interpret all sorts of things about you. So the obvious things are where you come from and your age, your gender and so on. But people also read into the way you speak things about your political attitudes, whether you're an aggressive person, a relaxed person, whether or not you're someone they'd like to get to know or someone that they'd rather not spend too much time with. And what happens to people who have changes to their speech because of strokes or head injuries, often they no longer have control over how they speak. And so they want to convey a caring, a happy or relaxed attitude, and people perceive it as aggressive or something.
So what happened to the Australian woman?
Yeah, well, that's precisely what the kind of things that she reports in the excerpt in the book there, that that people wouldn't let her finish sentences. They jumped in. They made assumptions about what she wanted to say, and they wouldn't take her seriously anymore because they thought this altered accent, this foreign accent, was just a joke, and she was putting it on. But they didn't realize. Behind her facade, where she was trying to put a positive spin on it all, how it was eating her away inside. This isn't me. The person you're shunning, or the person you're not taking seriously. I've got valid views. I've got things I want to say to you. Things are beliefs and feelings. So it's all this distancing and this breakdown in the empathy or the communication that there is between people just because of the altered accent.
Yes, indeed. Nick Miller is my guest this morning. He's a professor of motor speech disorders at Newcastle University in the UK. He's the author of Foreign Accent Syndromes, The Stories People Have to Tell. This experience of a syndrome where one day you might be speaking in one accent, the next, because of a trigger, you start speaking in another accent altogether. It's come from nowhere almost. So let's look at the causes. What are the potential? Why? What's happening neurologically? Have the fMRI studies, for example, revealed where this accent comes from?
Well, not so much where the accent comes from. What it is, if you imagine, as you're speaking, your brain, without you having to think that consciously about it, is thinking, what words do I need to express this idea? But more importantly, is when it comes to speech, what sounds do I need to use to produce those words? And what movements do I need to make of the tongue and lips and the vocal cords and so on to produce the sounds which will enable the listener to understand what I'm trying to say? And the whole system, this whole system of making sure that the right muscles are moving at the right time for the right length of time, the right strength of movement, distance of movement, so lips coming completely together or partially together, back of your tongue raising or the front of your tongue raising, and so on. Hundreds and hundreds of adjustments per second almost. If you have a stroke or head injury, certain part, that affects certain parts of the brain, this whole carefully balanced system gets out of kilter or is completely broken down. But in people with foreign accent syndrome, it's not completely broken down. It's a bit like
they can still speak. They can still speak, and they still have language. But in some cases, it's a striking transformation in accent.
That's right. So what can happen is that, for instance, you've got increased nasality in your speech. So instead of saying van and pan, you say van and pan. Which then people think, that's how a French person might speak. Mm. Or instead of saying fish and ship, you might say fish and sheep. Or instead of cricket, and you think, I think French or Spanish people speak English like that. So the listener doesn't hear it as a disordered speech or impaired speech in some way, that they pick up on what's familiar to them in hearing that kind of distortion in the words, and that's a French person speaking or a Spanish person speaking. Or another thing that can happen is that due to the brain damage, then you get an alteration to where you place the stress on words or the stress in the sentence. So instead of saying canoe, you might say canu. Or instead of saying I like to play cricket, you say I like to play cricket. Mm. And so again,
fascinating. Because
the words are perfectly understandable, but the listener hears this as an altered accent, and they associate that with a foreign accent that might be familiar to them.
So it's as much about foreign accent syndrome after a stroke or a head injury as much about how the listener interprets an accent as the actual change in the person's voice.
That's right.
There are cases. Nick, there are cases, though, where it's not stroke, it's not brain injury, but there are social and psychological reasons for foreign accent syndrome.
That's right. I guess in terms of the etiology, the origins of where the altered accents come from, there's one big group of origins which are associated with neurological damage, and then there are another whole group of origins where it's associated more with psychological changes or psychological issues in the person who's speaking, and that just the same way as some people develop a limp or develop a tick, a blink of the eye or whatever, because for psychological reasons rather than neurological reasons. Some people alter their accent for psychological reasons.
What might that be?
I guess there are as many reasons as there are people who develop a different accent. So it might be to gain some kind of sympathy or some kind of to identify with a particular group who does speak with that accent. It might be to put some kind of barrier up between your inner self and the outer world. So people, if they're going to criticize you, are criticizing this person who speaks with this funny accent, and they're not criticizing the you deep down inside, for instance.
Yes.
Or other people might find, for instance, I think there's another case that reported in the book we wrote, one of the cases we gathered, where a teenager who felt she didn't identify with the other teenagers in the school and was bullied by them, and her way of coping with that was to invent this whole new personality for herself, which included a different accent as well.
Goodness. So, I mean, yeah. This makes diagnosis often very challenging, I guess, for clinicians. Just briefly and finally, what are the therapeutic possibilities? I mean, there's no cure for this syndrome, and clearly it's as complex as recovery of all sorts of functions after stroke or head injury. But are there therapeutic options to help someone reclaim their original accent?
Well, there are. If you, a speech language pathologist, for instance, would analyze what is it about the changes to the person's speech, which sounds in particular or which stress and intonation patterns in the person's speech have altered, which are leading listeners to hear a foreign accent here, and then focus in the therapy on altering those particular sounds back to how the person spoke before. That would be one direction. But another direction, so even for people who have got foreign accent syndrome for neurological reasons, because they've had some kind of brain damage, there is this psychological, social side to it. So people not believing you from locally and having to rethink your whole identity. And a lot of the talking therapies or counselling therapies would be then the direction one might go to help the person readjust to this new person or help them to get back to realise, yes, deep down you are still the same person, you're still the same loving father or mother or sister or brother or whatever.
And develop that confidence within again that you've always been.
Yeah.
Look, the testimonies in this book are profound and powerful, and someone's just tweeted, we're lucky enough to have seen a case in Melbourne. A neuropsychologist has tweeted here, so, and they are very rare stories, which is sort of amazing given how common head injury and stroke is. But can I thank you, Professor Nick Miller, for making the time to stay up so late there in Newcastle in the UK.
Thanks ever so much for having me there.
Yes, great to speak to you. And Professor Nick Miller is a Professor of Motor Speech Disorders at the Institute of Health and Society at Newcastle University in the UK. His book with Jack Riles is Foreign Accent Syndromes, The Stories People Have to Tell. It's published by Psychology Press. And I just found that a very compelling insight into what is often kind of laughed about a bit as a novelty neurological disorder. We have to be careful not to parade out cases as a kind of vaudevillian freak show. So really nuanced understanding of that syndrome. Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. A story of love and passion and music next.
Hi, David Rutledge here. I present RN's feature documentary program Earshot, which you can hear weekday mornings at 11. Unless, of course, you can't. Now, with RN online and on mobile, you can catch Earshot anytime you like. You can catch Earshot anywhere you like. Out on the street, you can catch it at 30,000 feet. Hear now, hear later, hear anywhere. Hear, hear. Download the ABC Radio app now.
American music legends Tim and Jeff Buckley lives cut tragically short.
Now you wanna know the reason.
Both are now celebrated in the world premiere production of A State of Grace, featuring soul-stirring reinterpretations by Martha Wainwright, Willie Mason, Steve Kilby and others. As media partner, RN can put you there. Look for A State of Grace on the RN homepage.
We're just going to play that for the rest of the show. No guests. We're just going to listen to this glorious music. Yes, if music be the food of love, play on. Shakespeare knew well the overlap between music and love. So do the two musicians. Extraordinary, internationally acclaimed musicians who join me in the studio now. Husband and wife, Gil Shaham and Adele Anthony. Yes, you heard them playing there together. They are internationally renowned as one of the most brilliant couples in classical music. They met while studying together at the prestigious Juilliard School in New York. American-Israeli Gil was born in Illinois and is regarded as one of the most, well, really the greatest violinists in the world right now, described by Time magazine as the most outstanding American violinist of his generation. They're so humble, they're shaking their head
blushing,
at this.
I'm blushing.
Adele was born in Singapore, but she was then went to Tasmania and then went to Adelaide with her family. As I understand it, her talent was recognised early. She won the prestigious ABC Young Performers Award when she was just 13, and she's gone on to win many of the big international gongs too. Let's just say welcome to Australia. Welcome back to Australia.
Thank you.
And you're here because the Sydney Symphony Orchestra has struck gold. Both of you will be performing a series of concerts at the Sydney Opera House. Have you performed there before?
Yes, we have, and we're very happy to be back here in such a beautiful city.
Yeah, we feel so lucky to be here. Yeah, playing together is one of our favourite things to do.
Is it?
And to be here in Sydney. Yeah, we hardly ever get a chance. You know, we're usually chasing our three kids.
Three children. three children under the age of 10. 12, I should say. Yes. 12, 9 and 3.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And yeah. I guess I'm going to focus on this relationship because it's a relationship built on love and music. How did you meet?
You know, the interesting thing is we don't really remember meeting, but it's mutual, so it's all fine. But it was either at the Aspen Music Festival or at Juilliard too, which was around the same time we were at both places.
It took me a few years to work up the courage after we were together. And one evening I turned to Adele and I said, I can't remember when did we first meet? And then and Adele said she couldn't remember either. So
he was off the hook.
Yeah.
But I remember we would have classes together and he would sit next to me and come to class without any paper or pencils. So he would ask to borrow something. So I didn't know if that was just a way to make conversation.
The first fabulous pickup line is to ask to borrow a pen. Were your musical trajectories in childhood similar, Gil? Because you had an extraordinary music history which took you from America to Israel and beyond.
Well, I guess my family were, you know, my parents were scientists. But big music lovers, and so we had a lot of music in the house. And there were three of us. My older brother was taking piano lessons, and when I was maybe 7 years old, I asked my parents to start some violin lessons. I was jealous of my brother, and I wanted to be different. And at the time, my mother refused. You know, she said, "There's something about the sound of violin." Of little kids playing the violin that reminded her of fingernails on the chalkboard at school, you know, or like metal knives squeaking against each other. And so
she speaks the truth.
So actually, I have some tapes to prove it. It's true.
Even you sounded like nails down a chalkboard at one point.
So she said, well, maybe next year, and hoping that I would forget. But finally, I remembered. My brother went the way of the parents. He was the smart brother.
Because your dad's an astrophysicist, your mum a cytogeneticist.
That's correct, yes. And he became a biologist of sorts. And I guess music was a little bit more of a rebellion for me. And then for Adele's it was I think maybe slightly different story.
My
yes,
my
now what's
path
your story?
Was a little more direct.
You landed in Hobart as a little kid.
That's right. I was a baby when we moved there and we grew up there. My father is a violinist and he was a violinist in the Tasmanian Symphony. And then we moved to Adelaide later and he continued there to the Adelaide Symphony. And I began, you know, watching him play the violin and going to concerts. And the way they realized I enjoyed the violin was that I would follow him around the house imitating him with a brush and comb when I was very small. And in Hobart, they began the first Suzuki group there and I was in the second group.
You were tiny, weren't
you? I was two and a half when I started. So
tiny little violin.
Right, and 16th size. So, yeah, I was very fortunate to have that opportunity and stayed with it. I enjoyed violin ever since.
Now you share a life in New York together and you have three children. And I'm curious, Adele, of your observations about the way in which music education works over there compared to how it works here. I've been struck by, one figure, Don Spencer, who runs the Children's Music Foundation in Australia, quotes, and I couldn't find the source of this quote, that under 75% of Australian public schools don't have a specialist music teacher. Richard Gill, the acclaimed composer, has said that we are basically impoverished when it comes to musical education. So what's life like musically for your children in New York City?
I mean, our kids are very fortunate and their school has a very wonderful music program. Our son plays in an orchestra and our daughter, you know, will play in an orchestra next year.
She wants to?
Yes, she wants to. They both play violin of their own volition. We said to, you know, we wanted them to pick an instrument and they both chose violin. So, but it's true that I think in a lot of schools, when the budget is cut, that arts is the first thing to kind of go. So, but we're fortunate for them.
You know, at the risk of sounding mushy, it was
go on.
It was amazing for us to see when our first baby was born, and then the other two. But really, babies that are a few days old or even a few weeks old, you can see by the expression on their face, you can see them respond to music. And there's something about music and something about babies, you know, if we sort of process everything through language and concepts, babies seem to respond to stimuli, you know, if something happens too soon or too slowly or too quick or too fast or too loud or too soft.
They're ready to respond.
They
right
respond
there.
Emotionally.
And rhythm.
Very quickly. And that really is music. And there's something about this art that we love, and there's something about it that speaks to the pre-verbal person in all of us.
Yeah,
and it's probably an important part of ourselves to tap into.
There's a great evolutionary story there about which came first, music or speech, and how the two might have cooperated together. Speaking of cooperation, what does it feel like to perform with the love of your life on stage? How does it, just describe the dynamic of being together on stage in music, bathed in music that you're creating?
It's always such a nice feeling to walk on stage together because often you're on your own and it's a little lonely out there. So it's, you know, like having your best friend with you. And it's really one of our favourite things to do. And we haven't been able to do it as much now with the family because we... one of us is always at home, so it's hard to be together on the road. And I think we're lucky that we're compatible with our ideas and intonation.
Once the kids go to bed, you're not there sitting, strumming on. You've brought in the most incredible instruments.
Well, we thought maybe we could Maybe we could get a good price for them.
Yeah. well, what sort of price would you get for them? I mean, just describe what you've brought in.
Well, we brought both our fiddles, and I guess they're two Stradivarius, two Strad violins. Mine is a Strad, $16.99. Plus tax. Now that's the 1699th time I've used it.
Yeah.
No, it's $16.99 plus postage and handling.
That's right. That'd be $16 million and 99.
For you, $14.99.
Oh, bring it on. I'll buy it off you. That's a good deal.
It was made in the year 1699, and has a
goodness
beautiful history. It's named the Countess Polignac Stradivarius, after the original owner, who was the Countess of Polignac, on the court of Louis XIV, and she was very involved in Parisian musical life as well as Venetian musical life, and probably had a lot to do with Vivaldi and all those concertos we know and love.
So
and we know she commissioned many of them and brought Vivaldi's music out of Italy for the first time.
So this is a 300-year-old instrument.
300 years old, yeah, something like that.
I know you're not meant to be playing it in studio, but can you play one note?
Shall we do a little bit of Navara? You were playing a little Navara.
Yes, if you're up for it. Yeah. I know it's not the acoustically optimum environment, but our listeners are aching to hear. Glorious. Thank you. So what about your instrument?
So my instrument was made in 1728, and they're actually different models of Stradivarius. Mm. Gil's is the long pattern. It's actually kind of the more feminine looking.
1.0.
Yeah. So just what do you mean by that?
So his violin is kind of a very long, narrow pattern, and my Strad is a grand pattern Strad, so it's actually quite a lot wider.
Oh,
and
yes.
Broader, which I think for
more
me...
More hips.
Yeah, it enhances the bass on the violin, actually, I think. So they both have beautiful sounds, and it's just amazing that even though Stradivarius had models that worked so beautifully, he was always experimenting and changing the patterns on them, and they all sound so amazing.
Wow.
He was this incredible genius who lived into his 90s, and experimenting with the shape of the violin, ultimately hitting on what they now call the golden period, and all the while one instrument after the other just sounds magnificent.
What will you be performing here in Australia?
So we will be performing together the Bach Double Violin Concerto, which is absolutely one of the best pieces written for two violins.
Yeah.
And I'll be performing the Bach E major concerto and Gil the Bach A minor concerto.
And do you get back to Australia much?
Not as often as we'd like. I think
busy life in New York.
As we have had more kids, it's longer and longer between trips. But, you know, we like to come as often as possible.
Look, it's such a pleasure to have you both in the studio and with those gorgeous instruments and with those historical stories too. I mean, just finding these instruments must be a sort of precious process.
Very difficult, yeah. And for a musician, you know, the instrument that you play means so much. It is a lifelong relationship, and that's true whether it's a violin or a piano or a clarinet. And each instrument has their own personality. You know, when you're talking about very tiny microfibers of wood that vibrate a certain way, they really do have their own personalities, their own caprices, you know. And, we're really very, very lucky with these ones.
And we're playing out with Sarasate, I think. Sarasate's Carmen Fantasy. I think this is you. It is you, isn't it? Yes, it is you. Oh, look, Gil Shaham, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having
us. And Adele Anthony, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And enjoy being on that stage at the Sydney Opera House, one of the most wonderful places to perform in the world.
Can't wait.
And welcome back to Australia.
Thank you.
Oh, Michael Cathcart. Are you there, sir?
I'm so envious. I'd love just once in my life to hold a Stradivarius and play it, even though I wouldn't sound like this. Just to play an open G string. I would be happy. Hey, I'm going to talk to Sophie Laguna in a minute, who's won the Miles Franklin Award. Hooray!
Oh, that's... I heard an interview with her, a very brief one on AM. It was compelling.
Yeah.
So I'll be listening in after the news for Books and Arts. Thanks, Michael.
No worries.
News time. It's 10 a.m.